Hello and welcome to episode 412 of Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
James Jones is my rapper name.
And John Lindemann.
John Lindemann is my James Jones name.
Fair. That's a good James Jones name.
And Guillaume Veillette.
I go by J Wizzle.
J Wizzle.
Mm-hmm. I wish you did, because that would be just possibly the most terrible thing anyone has ever done in the history of the world.
Yeah. Well, this is the first episode of RFN that we are recording in the new year. The last one we recorded in the taint between Christmas and New Year's, and then it came out a few days after New Year's. But this is a brand new world for us. I'm in a new state, a new apartment. I still don't have any furniture, but I'm getting by. Of course, I have my TV, and I have my games, and I've been playing a few, and so have these guys, and we have a lot of games to talk about. I'm not sure that we're going to get to any emails or anything else on this episode, because there's just a bunch of stuff that we want to get through, and I think it'll be stuff that everybody will want to hear about, but we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. but we have been trying to cram in a bunch of games before we do our top fives. Right now, the plan is next week. We're going to do our top five games of 2014. There'll be personal lists, of course, so you'll probably get a pretty good mix, even with the, you know, kind of a record low number of releases on Nintendo platforms last year. I think you'll still get a pretty good variety, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm also still cramming myself.
Pray for us.
Since John and Guillaume were not on the episode last time, because they were on their holiday breaks, and I thought we would start with them. So, John, how about you go first, and we'll just do one game at a time and keep going around the board.
All right. Well, first one up here is one near and dear to both of our hearts, Johnny. We have a lot of history. A lot of history with this game. Bionic Commando Elite Forces, for Game Boy Color, which is a recent addition to the eShop. So Johnny, you brought this to my attention. This was the first game that we played together, probably, what, at E3? Was it E3 99?
No, it was 2001.
So, okay, 2001. Which Bionic Commando relaunch is this?
Well, it's the original relaunch.
The original relaunch, okay.
Unless you consider the NES game to be a relaunch of the arcade game.
I mean, technically speaking, but that's not what I meant.
Yeah. No, this was the first time that Bionic Commando had been revived, and by Nintendo, no less, not even Capcom. Yeah. And I don't know whether this game paved the way for the rearmed thing that came out on, you know, 360 and PS3 a few years ago, but it's really awesome.
Yeah. So at E3, we played this. I remember we were sitting in line, weren't we, waiting for something? We played this.
Yeah,
We played Pokemon Pinball, did we not?
I'm sure we did. Yeah.
For the Game Boy Color, by the way.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And John had not seen Bionic Commando. I think I'd gotten it earlier. I think it had probably come out earlier that week. And I know I'd played it a lot on the plane on the way to E3. And we were waiting in line to get into the show, because I used to do that. To me, being at E3, it was like the greatest thing in the universe. So I would just get up really early and go sit in line at the front doors and just try to be the first one in there. And so we had a whole big group of Planet GameCube people who I had was just meeting for the first time. And John and I had probably met the day before.
Yeah.
And John, I was playing the game, and you were asking about it and checking it out. And I'm sure you borrowed the system and played a little bit yourself. And I distinctly remember you saying, "Man, I'm going to have to get this."
Yeah, and I
did.
Did you
mean 15 years later?
No, I believe I did have it. See, because I actually got rid of my Game Boy Color. I traded it in, which I kind of regret now. I traded it in on, I think, on the DS. I think, or no, on I traded it on the GBA. Sorry, on
the GBA. Right, because the GBA would have been backwards compatible, and the DS was not with the Game Boy
Color.
That's
right.
Yeah, exactly.
And the GBA came out around a month later, I think so. E3 was in May that year, and I think GBA came out in the first week of June in 2001. So it was, I mean, we were playing tons of GBA stuff at E3 that year. It was the first time any of us, other than Billy, because he was at Space World the year before, but it was the first time that most of us had ever played GBA.
Yep.
So this was right on the cusp. And you know, because it was like a late Game Boy Color game that came out right before GBA did, mm-hmm. not that many people played it, I think.
Right. I mean, no. I never
hear people talk about it.
The Game Boy Color didn't have that long of a life before the Game Boy Advance came out.
Yeah.
It came out in 98, and then so basically 2.5 years before mm-hmm. GBA.
So yeah, so this game is made by NST, mm-hmm. which is, of course, the offshoot of DigiPen, if I remember correctly. Am I right there?
Well, it's an offshoot of Nintendo of America,
yeah,
but it's affiliated
with DigiPen. Yep. So this is kind of a in-house software group that I believe is defunct now.
No, is it still around? They're not very active. I think they make a lot of tools.
They make a lot of tools. They do some menu stuff. They also occasionally make a Mario versus Donkey Kong game.
Exactly. Yep. Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
That's what they do. That's about all they do.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, and it's good. I mean, it's true to the formula of the original Bionic Commando, unlike Bionic Commando Rearmed and Reloaded or whatever you want to call it. The only thing I don't like about it is that game's pretty true.
I mean, that game's like a.
Yeah, I think that faithful anime. Maybe you're confusing it with the 3D game.
Yes, Rearmed. I am confusing it with. Yes.
Oh, right.
There was the other 2D one. Jesus.
Like I said, I'm forgetting these.
They
relaunched this franchise like 4 times.
Yeah, man. Well, James, let me introduce you to a company called Capcom.
No, you can't, because Capcom doesn't fucking make games anymore that aren't called Monster Hunter.
Well, right, and they didn't make this one either. I mean, this was all Nintendo, but.
So this is right around the same time that Nintendo also released Crystalis on the Game Boy Color, which is also not one of their games.
Well, Crystalis is a port of the NES game. It's not a remake.
Sure,
it's a kind of a broken port. It's not very good.
Oh, we've talked about it a lot, but
was also made by NST. But Bionic Commando Elite Forces is actually an original game. I mean, it's based on Bionic Commando, but it's all new graphics, new level designs, new power ups. Completely mm-hmm. new content, and I think it's the best thing that company ever made.
Okay, but is it a new character at least? Is it like, tell me the character is not named Rad Spencer.
The default character is a girl.
No, it's not.
The default character is a Lady Bionic Commando. That's how fresh it is.
Yeah,
but you can also select a male character if you want.
Yeah, and I mean the plot is that you have to just kill the general of some, you know, whatever, destroy the army that's invading your country or whatever. But, it plays exactly like the old school Bionic Commando on the NES. Adds maybe a couple of wrinkles here and there. You have, you choose where to go on your map. And, sometimes when you're in between points on the map, you can get attacked by troops, which takes you to an overhead view battle where it's almost like, some of the battles from Contra 3, some of those battles, the overhead battles in Contra 3, if I'm remembering correctly.
Or the original Commando, which is what it was meant to be a tribute to.
True. Yeah, it's very true, very true.
Because Bionic Commando is the original Capcom game is supposed to be a spinoff of the original Commando, which was an earlier Capcom game.
Mm-hmm. And it plays pretty well. I mean, there's a couple of gripes I have. I wish your character sprite looked a bit better. Sometimes the swinging doesn't feel as tight as it does in the original NES version. Like, that's one of the things I really, really liked. I always felt like you had a really good sense of grabbing onto something and being able to, it just felt really snappy. Like, it just felt, it was always very, very, you always felt like a really good response when you grabbed onto something. So, and it's a little bit, I don't know, I feel like it's a little bit slow on this one, but it's still good. It's still good. And you can, it throws in a couple wrinkles, like, you can snipe stuff,
in the background.
Yeah, you can do some of that, which triggers a kind of a relief package that floats down from the sky, and you can, renew your health and stuff. Usually there's a midpoint where you can save in each area, and you can, save your game there, and, you can also tap into, communications between the enemies and see kind of what's going on. And sometimes you trigger stuff from that. And you can also contact people back at the base and all that kind of stuff. So it's good. I mean, I haven't played too deep into it. I think I've beaten the first couple of bosses. The bosses are kind of simplistic. I find a lot of times you just, you figure out the way to do it very quickly. and you can just repeat that over and over again, and they're done. But it's extremely obvious. Like, oh, like you see their pattern right away. Like with the second boss, he has a shield and he shoots at you, but he never jumps. So all you do is you jump up above him, and then when he shoots up at you, his shield is raised, which leaves him open to your fire, and you drop down and shoot him. And you just keep repeating that. So you pretty much just jump in a circle over and over and over again until he's dead. So it's pretty obvious. So
yeah, that's one of the easier ones, though. They do get more complicated later on. And they do a lot of damage.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you pretty much have to perfect it so you can't get hit. I mean, you don't have a whole lot of shots. But that's the thing. I mean, I know, like Johnny, I know that you can choose the guns. How are the guns further on down the line if you've played further than I have?
I think I'm on zone area 9 or 10, so I'm roughly halfway through the game. There's some backtracking you can do. I don't know if you have to, but it's at least an option later on in the game. And there's some levels that you'll find on the map early, but you can't go into them yet. And so there will be some backtracking later on, but I'd say I'm about halfway through, and I only have one other gun. It's a three-way gun, and it has a shorter range than the default. But it's useful, especially once you start encountering flying enemies. Since you can't jump, if an enemy is kind of hovering right above you and there's nothing for you to latch onto and pull yourself up to shoot him, then you really need something with a little bit more directionality in order to get him. Or you can try to make him chase you and get into a better position that way. Yep. But, you know, if you've never played a Bionic Commando game, I think it's – maybe we're taking for granted just how many people are familiar with this, because this – I'm pretty sure this is the first time the series has ever been on Virtual Console, which means it's the first time it's been on a Nintendo system since this game came out in 2001.
No, that's not true, because the Game Boy version of the original NES game is already in the Virtual Console.
Okay. Well, this game is better than that one. I can tell you that. Although, you know what? I did actually play that one when it came out. It's just very forgettable because it's...
Well, it's kind of a lesser version, a downgraded version from the NES game, right?
Whereas this one is actually, it's basically a sequel. I mean, it's completely new content. It's very familiar and faithful to the formula, but they do add new power-ups, new levels, new bosses, new story, and a few kinks, you know, like the sniping into the background, which is basically a mini game, but it's really cool. It looks awesome.
Yeah.
And, this is, I think, one of the best Game Boy Color games, and I think it's great. Of course, I'm just a humongous fan of Bionic Commando. All the 2D games I just adore. Yeah. So I own a copy of this somewhere in a box somewhere in my parents' house, but I was very happy to pay $5 to play it again. I think a lot more people should play this game.
Yeah, it has really good music, too. I was surprised how good the music is. It's really impressive. Kind of, you know, that sort of 8-bit chiptune music, but still, you know, it's updated and better, but it still kind of retains that same kind of flavor. So I really like that. But yeah, I mean, it's really good. I think everybody should really pick it up if you've ever been curious about the Bionic Commando series, because it's kind of, I wish Bionic Commando was, I wish it would have, you know, done better than it has. I don't know. I feel like it's kind of been forgotten, and you know, I feel like the 360, the 360 version of it, the 3D one, I think that really killed it. You know,
well, I mean, Rearm 2 came out after that game.
True.
It did, but it wasn't nearly as good. It was made by a different developer, and they added jumping, which is just sacrilege.
Sure.
For this
well,
series.
I mean, keep in mind, that's four games that have come out. Well, I mean, we'll leave Elite Forces. It's kind of an outlier, but that's three games that came out since like 07. Before Elite Forces, there hadn't been a Bionic Commando game since 92. I mean, it's kind of keeping pace on its release.
They were legitimately trying to revive it at one point, but Rearmed was a huge flop, and the 3D game was a huge, huge, huge flop.
Well, they had Hot Dog Hands. I mean,
I think Ty Sugard is a big fan. You know, he likes certain games that people hate.
Of course he is.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not disparaging him there. I believe I remembered hearing
him. I mean, even if he isn't, he'll probably claim it now.
Yeah. It's up there with Final Fight.
Streetwise. Final Fight, Streetwise, where you kill roaches for money. It's fine.
Yep. Elite Forces is just... it's just awesome. It's just a fantastic 2D action platformer game that you probably haven't played, And now you can play it portably on your 3DS anytime, and it's super cheap. Why wouldn't you go buy it?
Yeah, also plenty of the save points are also laid out pretty nicely. Like you say,
yeah,
your
it's
game
more
a lot.
Forgiving than yeah. most of the games in this series. It's if you've never played Bionic Commando, I think this would be a really good place to start because it does run a little slower. There's a little less action on the screen because the Game Boy Color, you know, had that little bitty screen, and so they don't throw a ton of enemies at you because you can't see them until they get really close. Yeah. So it tends to be a little bit more forgiving there. You can very easily farm extra lives at the overhead mini stages, and it's I think it's just one of the easier games in the series, but it's
it
so
is.
Much fun.
Yeah, it's a good game.
Yeah. Everybody who's playing it right now is just raving about it on Twitter. I know Neil's crazy about it. Zach Miller's crazy about it.
Yep.
You know, people with pretty diverse tastes can all agree that Bionic Commando Elite Forces is the bomb.
One other NST note before we roll through. So they made this. They made the Crystalis port. Mm-hmm. They made another game owned by another company, yet a third company who owns the license right afterwards, the N64. Do you know what it is?
Oh, N64? Or they did Ridge Racer 64?
They did. Those were three games in a row. They made three games in a row that they don't own the license to.
Yeah.
That's bizarre. Nintendo published third-party games. Nintendo developed published third-party games.
Yeah, developed and published.
That's weird.
Well, maybe that's going to make a comeback.
It's true.
They got to do something, right? All right, well, why don't we move on to Guillaume, who's played a game that I know for a fact we have received requests to talk about this game on the show.
Oh, really?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, over the holidays, I've been mostly playing with people, you know, local multiplayer games, couch multiplayer games, and one of those games was much better than the others, and this game is Sports Ball, which I don't think has been very popular, maybe because of the kind of generic name. When you type Sports Ball in Google, you do not find Sports Ball. And if you type, like, Sports Ball Nintendo, you're going to find stuff about, like, the Pokemon Sport Ball.
To be fair, this may be influenced by my history, but Sports Ball is the first link when I type Sports Ball in Google. So.
Really? But it's not link 2 or 3 or 4, though, right?
No, it's number 1. Nintendo's webpage for it.
Yeah, but that's the only one you can find.
Oh, well, yeah, that's the only one that matters.
Yeah, well, anyway. It's... Sorry. Yeah.
Right off topic.
Owned by Google.
Owned by James.
I would blame Kit.
Sergey Brin spits in your face.
Soon we will all be owned by Google.
So, yeah, it's this couch multiplayer game. It's on the Wii U eShop, and it's very simple. If you recall Joust, the original arcade game where you're controlling these kind of ostriches, these riders and ostriches with these, you know, jousting spears, that's basically what the game is like, except that you're not necessarily riding ostriches, you're riding, like, chickadees and chickens and... I don't know, other birds that I've never even heard of before, but they're all like kind of like, I think they're all real, and I think they're all very detailed. Like my girlfriend who likes bird watching was actually like very excited to be identifying them. But yeah, like it's this really weird like alternate reality where there's these sports ball arenas all around the world, like in real places, like the historic Melbourne arena or the newly constructed Space Tokyo Dome or something. And all these arenas are one single screen. And I don't know if you recall, like back in episode 301, I talked about playing this game called Super Mario War on a hacked Wii. And it was this game, again, like, it was this arena, it was taking Mario sprites, and it was just, like, these one-screen arenas, and the game would wrap around, like, not just horizontally, like, exiting left, and you appear at the right of the screen, but also vertically. You know, if you fell into a hole, you would appear at the top. And that made for just, like, very chaotic matches, where you're just trying to stump each other, and you drop in holes, and you fall down from the ceiling unexpectedly, and it's just pure madness.
Towerfall is the same way, which is also a fantastic couch multiplayer game.
Right. So Sportsball does this, and again, like, it's just pure chaos. But you're not just trying to kill each other. You've also got these tons of balls that spawn when you kill an enemy. Like, kill someone, and you're going to get, like, two balls of your team's color. And you try to get these balls into this tiny net in the middle of the screen. Or some arenas have several nets. And it's just, like, at first you don't know what you're doing, right? Like, it just kind of seems impossible to actually control what you're doing with the balls, because you're just mashing the A button to hover, and you press the B button sometimes to dive down more rapidly instead of just letting gravity letting you fall back down. And you're not really sure what you're doing, and actually pushing these balls around doesn't seem to be all that... You know, it doesn't seem possible to have any control over them. So it's just chaotic, and you're just basically trying to bump into each ball to turn them into your team's color, and then hope that by accident they're going to drop in the net and you're going to score a point. But you know, like, eventually you kind of get used to the madness, and you start developing some strategies. And what's unfortunate is that you're probably going to try to develop these strategies, or you're probably going to try to master these controls while you're playing with other people, right? Like, I had four people over here, like, we're all playing it, and it's just not really a good time or a good setting to really understand the finesse of a game's controls. So it's kind of sad that they couldn't include, like, some sort of tutorial in the game. Like, I was looking at the developer's website, which is like the seventh or eighth link in Google when I search for sports ball, and they've got a link to some video where they show, like, just how freaking precise you can be with those controls, and how you can actually, like, carry a ball around and to the net. And it's just insane to watch, because while you're playing it the first time, you don't think that's possible. But so yeah, I kind of wish that they had just included those videos in their game. It seems like it could have been something easy to do, or I don't know, integrated into Miiverse, like in worst case scenario. But yeah, it's just, even if you don't understand exactly what you're doing, it's just craziness. I don't know, it's just a really well done Wii U game. Like, it's very simplistic, but it's very, very well made. Like, there's this, the art style, I'm not sure how to describe it. Like, I was asking, like, to my girlfriend, like, what do you name art styles where, like, everything is kind of like simple shapes? And it's not really minimalist in this case, because it's very detailed. But
like cubic, maybe, or something? Or
no,
I was gonna say mosaic.
No, it's more like, I don't know. It could be minimalist, but very detailed. It's like, it's vector graphics, so it's got that kind of look, yeah, of just using these basic shapes, but then they add more details to it. Anyway, yeah, look it up on YouTube. Although it doesn't really do it justice, but like these really nice looking logos for each team, you know, like the Pink Bros have this flamingo, and like the...
Wait, are they really called the Pink Bros?
The Pink Bros, yeah.
That's it's so great.
It's pretty amazing. definitely my favorite team name. But yeah, and like you've got, you know, like these cool looking, like kind of warlike, like the rooster or whatever, and it's just amazing. So yeah, the game looks really good, and what I do like also is that they try to make use of the Wii U's features. Like, this is, so far, I think it's an exclusive, and so they try to use the mic to add, like, you can be a commentator on the game, you can be an announcer. Unfortunately, like, there were only four of us. I was using the gamepad. I had to be the announcer, and I couldn't really do it while I was playing, but you know, like, all you have to do is hold down one of the triggers and just speak into the mic, like James Smells. Not you, James. I know more than one James.
There are no more other Jameses.
So does it distort it? Does it make it sound like you're like the stadium PA announcer?
No, I think you have to have to make it sound good, you have to have natural talent to be an announcer, which I don't have. So maybe, like, have someone, like, if you're more than four people and at a party or something, like, have someone who's not actually playing, yeah, you know, comment the match. And no, it's pretty cool.
It's a cool feature. This is a weird concept, though, to have someone speaking into the gamepad and relaying that out of the TV when presumably the people in the room can just hear you the first time, right?
Yeah, sure. Well, just maybe like over everyone shouting, like if you're having an especially crazy party, or you know, so turn up the volume of the TV. Sure,
I mean, it's you know, it's an Easter egg more or less. It's just not hidden. I mean, it's just it's a bonus thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I found it pretty cool.
It's a neat idea. I feel like maybe they could do more with it. But right. I like where they're going with that.
Yeah. And before you get this game, it's $10. Just be warned that it's, unless you have some people to play it with locally, maybe it's not worth it, because only one mode is available when you're playing solo, and it's a training mode, and you're just trying to get, you know, a series of points in a series of situations. It will help you get better at the game, but, you know, the end goal, like, it's more desirable to be playing against other people. And also, you know, like, Karen likes a game, but when you've got two people, then you've only got basically the dual mode. And it's a little bit too intense for her, I think. Like, usually we play co-op games. Here, we were kind of evenly matched. Like, we played two games. It was like, it ended, like, she won 5-4, and then I won 5-4. And just, like, she was, oh, no, this is too much. This is just too stressful. I don't want to play this anymore. So, yeah, it's a good game to bust out at parties, though.
Okay. Yeah, sounds good. Well, James, you're up next, and James, just for everyone listening, just so you know, James would not tell us what he's been playing for the show. So
strictly classified. He's
held it as a surprise.
So I teased this game on Twitter a few weeks ago when I was trying to figure out what game I wanted to play for the show, and it was in the list, but I didn't make a comment about it. I just kind of left it there, and I went onto Twitter and sort of just
Sonic Boom
vented. Yes, it's Sonic Boom, and vented about this game a little bit. And somebody immediately figured out what game I was talking about, which is not Sonic Boom. So I ended up buying. So take a step back. This is a Tecmo Koei published RPG developed by Gust Co. Limited in Japan, which the full title of the game, this is really a long title, is Atelier Esha and Logi, Alchemist of the Dusk Sky, which is Japanese as hell.
Sounds legit.
Yeah, it's super legit, actually. That's the scary part. And the reason I ended up with this game is there have been a lot of these PS3 Atelier games that have come out in the West. Like, a couple came out on the PS2, whatever. There was a DS game that I ended up with when I bought like four games for a flight to LA, because I've talked about on the show, whenever I fly, I buy like two or three games used. I grab DS games I don't know that I quickly find on my phone had goodish reviews. So fuck it, let's give it a shot. But I'd never really gotten into this series, and for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why they keep bringing these games to the U.S. Because they brought like five in a row every year. They would bring one, and for the
like record of Agarest War that you see on
it's like
PSN store over and over.
But these were retail releases. These weren't even digital. These were on shelves at. You'd go to GameStop, and there'd be like six of these things lined up, and you're like, "What the fuck? Why do these keep coming?" So, I've kind of always kept in mind that there are people who love the shit out of these games. But the thing is, the first three that came out on the PS2 should best be described as simply being Moe in the most extraordinary way. And if you're not familiar with that term, it's a Japanese slang term that, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it. It's like trying deliberately to be just over the top cute. You know, in like, it generally pertains to things like anime targeted at girls. It's almost a little pejorative, but they sort of own it. And all three of those games, when you looked at their cover, you're like, no, I don't want any part of this. This one, I was told, had backed off of that. So I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. So here's basically what the game is.
Well, hold on. Just to clarify, which platform?
Oh, this is a PS3. All of these games have been on PS3 except for the DS.
PS3.
Yeah.
And what is the short version of the title?
It's simple.
Again?
It's simply referred to as Atelier Esha and Logi.
Atelier Esha and Logi.
So Atelier.
All right.
Basically, the idea is that you are an alchemist, and your job is to make stuff, and you are given quests to make things, and I mean that's basically what the crux of the game is. There is, there's essentially two play modes. One where you go and you do work in your atelier, where you're making things, and the other where you go out into these dungeon-like areas and fight enemies and collect material. Essentially, you have a quarter, 3 months, to complete a set of tasks that have been given to you, including one that's important for progressing the story, and then the rest that just gets you bonuses for doing them. And, I mean, that's ultimately, the game just comes down to time management. And the problem is that, alright, so your job is essentially to take ingredients to make the best version of an item you can, and then use that to make a better version of another item. And this death spiral of you plunging time into trying to make the best version of this sword for this one character that you use in your party once every 3 battles at best could really just take hold and become an obsessive adventure. So from a story standpoint, it is an RPG, it's pretty weak. But from a system standpoint, this game has so many so well-developed systems that it's difficult to talk about. I mean, getting past the fact that even this less moe version of this game is still sometimes uncomfortably Japanese. There's this really complicated interplay between the fact that you have a limited number of days to do work, the fact that you have these tasks, some of which will simply require you to, you know, travel 9 days out to a location to complete the task and then 9 days back. You're sort of forced to micromanage your time and understand how you can stack things. So, okay, on the way there, I can do this. You've got to manage, you don't want to over-collect because you may run out of space and not be able to collect other items. You have to figure out what you need to fight to get rewards. There's all this stuff going on that allows you to sort of, you have to kind of keep managing in your head, and the game's constantly feeding you new things to do. So the combat system, I'm, I don't know, 20-ish hours into the game, and it's still introducing new elements to the combat that really kind of work. I mean, this game's, when I say the systems are well-developed, this game has an incredibly, the combat seemed really, really basic when I picked it up. And at this point now, I understand there's a lot of strategy and understanding when to swap characters mid-fight to protect them, knowing when you should bring people in and to chain attacks together. There's like multiple types of, to use a relatively well-known version of it, like a Final Fantasy VII limit break. There's different ways you can trigger different types. There's all kinds of stuff that the game constantly gives you. And I don't know, it's just really enjoyable to sit here and learn new systems, because that's the kind of thing that I really enjoy from some games, is the ability to constantly gain new, try new things and have to learn to manage more tasks. And I understand this sounds an incredibly spreadsheet heavy game, and in a lot of ways it is. But there's a certain simple joy to combining elements, you know, understanding that I can take, you know, maybe multiple ingredients can be used in this slot for this recipe, but this one particular one will give me an extra boost of some extra bonus or some stat boost on the item. So
it's an RPG. I mean, it's a particular flavor.
Yeah, it's
RPG,
a mix of an RPG and like just a hardcore crafting game, like to the point of an incredible amount of detail going into understanding how to, you know, produce the optimal version of this item.
And James, I'm looking at this game on, I did a Google image search.
Yeah,
am I correct in thinking this game is beautiful?
It is beautiful. Like the character models.
Holy, like I was like, when I pulled up this page, I was like, wait, where are the screenshots?
Yeah, the character models especially are incredibly detailed.
Yeah, this is like Ni No Kuni, but with maybe more of a traditional anime art style.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of the style of the characters in the CG sequences of Fire Emblem Awakening. But way more colorful. Everything in this game is very colorful. The game world is a lot less detailed, but these character models are actually really, really nice. The enemy models are also really nice. There's some big bads in the game that are kind of stunning to look at. It's the funny thing about a game like this, and I understand how they make these games now, is that you can tell where they put the budget. Like, you could say, okay, they really were concerned about making that work. And you can see where they looked at stuff and said, we don't need to worry too much about that. So, like, to give you an example, the music in this game, I wouldn't say it's great music, but it's obviously, you know, very well funded. There is a ton of Japanese singers singing just music at random points of the game. But like the background art, well, the levels are actually really small. Essentially what it is every zone on your map is subdivided into smaller zones that you can explore. And these are all really small areas, and you just kind of go from one to the next. So they didn't spend a lot of time building a big world. but they made up for it by cramming them full of just stuff you can do. So I really respect how developed the systems are for this game. And of course, the fact they're making one every year, it should be. But it's really easy to get obsessive here. Because most of all, because the entire game is essentially you completing tasks. You're either completing tasks for your boss, you're getting tasks from the town that you live in for bonuses, and you're learning to stack tasks together. You're learning to try to produce the most optimal version of an item. You're trying to find ways to break the economy, and I've thoroughly fucking broken the economy at this point. I found an item that I could make.
That's your specialty, isn't it? That's just kind of what you do.
I found an item that is really expensive, but that I found ways to merge items to make the ingredients for this item, to merge items again, to stack on a bunch of these extra stat bonuses like very expensive or rare item +++, and then sell it for about 30 times its normal value. So, and then I just have a thing that just, there's this other system for manufacturing items you've already made. So I'm just cranking out like 50,000 gold every few days. And I can't buy anything. I've bought everything there is to buy. There's literally nothing left to buy, but I'm still doing it because it's fun. Breaking the shit out of this game is fun. I don't know. I just enjoy that they've put all this stuff, all these ways you can play the game, all these things you have to kind of keep straight in your head. And I like getting down to the end of a quarter and I've got like 7 days left and maybe I've completed all my tasks for the quarter. I'm sitting there going, all right, do I want to bank these 7 days for the next task or do I want to try to take a job real quick? What do I want? It's just really fun to sit there and work through it. And because you can rattle through this stuff so fast, it is so easy to lose track of time playing this game to the point where I've looked up and gone, oh, it's 3 a.m. I'm in trouble. I've got work tomorrow.
Yeah, I think you have a particular weakness for this sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's...
Because when you say this game is so much fun, it's so easy to play, and I'm thinking, it doesn't sound that great to me. I mean, it's... I would love to maybe watch some videos of it.
It is
super beautiful, but I don't think I would get a whole lot of enjoyment out of playing this the way you are.
This is a game for people who really get into this kind of system-level stuff. I mean, in a way,
It sounds min-maxy. Really, like
could definitely min-max the shit in this game. I mean,
So
I'm using, I may make a sword and use that sword as to remake it again, just to boost its stats a little bit. I may do that 3 times, but because you have to manage time, like the number of days you have, it's sort of, it does a very good job of pacing you to say, all right, you need to go out and do stuff now because, you know, you're wasting time doing this other thing. And it's just, they're really good at making this game because they make it so much that to come in and play a very late model version of this game and sort of see the polished version of it. It's they're very good at getting you hooked into it because they know how to expose it. They know how to teach it to you. They know how to develop it. They know how it should mature and change as the game goes on. So it's just super well put together. It's sort of, in a way, it sort of scratches the same itches I get when I'm playing like Ogre Battle. Like the battles at this point with Ogre Battle, whatever, they're, because I'm so good at putting together the army, the battles are trivial.
Right.
So it's kind of getting me.
Whereas
in the same
for me,
way.
The battles always seem like a struggle because my army is not organized properly.
Right. The battles are almost.
And so the battles feel very arbitrary and frustrating in Ogre Battle.
Right. For me, the battles are almost like I treat them like a computer program. I know what's going to happen before anything starts.
Yeah. Well, and you do Fire Emblem the same way, basically, don't you?
To an extent, but I don't play Fire Emblem games over many times, maybe once. Mm-hmm. So I've never gotten one that I understand so intricately. But this game does such a good job teaching you that you can be that level of expert on it in your first playthrough.
Hmm.
Now you will struggle right away, but it's constantly giving you new stuff at a good pace. And every time I'm going to introduce something new, do you want to see a tutorial? If you want to see it, go ahead. They're usually not very helpful because usually the menus are well enough constructed you don't really need it. But it's super approachable. And if you
That's surprising because, you know, especially a game with this kind of title.
Yeah.
You know, and when you find out that it's like the fifth one in the series
or
whatever.
No, it's like the 30th if you count the ones that came out in Japan.
Oh, geez. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, super niche and it's one of those, you know, anime games that, you know, American otaku sort of speak about in hushed tones.
Yeah.
You know, you just, from afar, you think, that's a game I could never get into. I just don't, you know, I'm way too late to jump on that train. It's not made for people like me. It's made for people who are going to obsess over it and who play a lot of things that are roughly similar to it, or at least in the same vein. But I'm really surprised to hear that you think it's so approachable and accessible.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll work better for certain kinds of people, but you know who you are if that's you. Like, if you've ever looked at these games on the store shelf and gone, maybe, like, definitely it's worth a shot, and it's not super expensive at this point because it's a PS3 game that came out in 2014. At the end of 2014. Actually, I think it came out in the middle.
Okay.
But yeah. I mean, it is what it is. This is, I'm having a lot of fun with it. I don't think I'll go buy the next one when it comes out, but it was, you know, I wanted to understand how the hell they could make this game every year and it be profitable for them. And now I get it. There are definitely hardcore fans that are super into this game. Mm-hmm. And I can see why.
And you're one of them.
Well, I will say, like, online, there are amazing resources for this game. Because the kind of people who obsess over this stuff are also the kind who will go make the most obsessive game fact ever.
Yeah.
So it's beautiful. It's
cool.
It's really fun.
All right. Well, I'm going to finish up round one of new business before we take a break with another game that is equally Japanese as Atelier, Esha, and Logi. But I think a lot more familiar to our listeners, and that would be Bayonetta, the first one. And James talked about it a few weeks ago, and much like James, I bought the 2-pack. Wanted to play through Bayonetta 2 before we do our top fives of the year, and I'm not going to finish either one of these games before that, but I did want to play the first one first. At least I'm kind of thinking I'm going to play maybe halfway through the first game and then jump into the second one, and that way I can sort of see what's changed, what's the same, and then I think I'll be okay to go back and finish the first one, and even then it'll be kind of like a true before and after, you know, like I'll really get a good sense of like what are the differences between the two. But by most accounts, they're not that different, you know. I mean, two is better, everyone likes it better than the first Bayonetta, but they're not that different. And so I've been playing, I think I'm up to chapter 4 now. I don't know how many there are, but I've played it for a couple
like
hours
16.
At least. Really?
Well, yeah, but some of them are like weird, like mini game chapters.
Right.
Okay. Well, I thought it was farther through it than that.
Nope.
But I guess not. Geez.
I made the same mistake when I was playing. Oh, I'm probably pretty close. I'm an 8. Nope.
Well, I mean, you know, on the other hand, it's nice to know that they're fairly meaty games because, you know, certainly, you know, when you compare it to something like Asura's Wrath, which we've, you know, discussed as a point of comparison recently.
Well, hold on. Asura's Wrath isn't actually a good game. It's just fun because it's stupid.
Okay. Bayonetta 2 is a similar thing in that it's just, you know, over-the-top wacky cutscenes, but it's married to a really tight, fun action game. And I've actually played the first couple hours of Bayonetta 1 when it first came out back in, 2009? I rented it on Gamefly back when I used to have Gamefly, and I played it on the 360, I think. And it just didn't click with me. I didn't know what I was expecting it to be, basically a God of War, Devil May Cry type thing. And I mean, it is and it isn't, you know. It is in the sense that if you know how to play those games, you can pick up Bayonetta. But I had played those games. They're not my favorite kind. And Bayonetta being an original franchise at the time, it throws you so far in the deep end with the story and with the characters, and it's so utterly confusing and nonsensical, especially in the beginning, that I just found it really, it seemed like it was trying way too hard at the time, and I didn't get very far into it.
Yeah, I kind of had the same experience when, after years and years of hearing about that series, like long after even the fourth game came out, I tried Devil May Cry for the first time.
Oh, no. You started with 4? Oh, okay.
Yeah, 4.
No,
is not
I,
a
didn't,
good
I didn't. I didn't start with 4.
Oh, okay,
I went
but
back,
say
like,
why?
But, you know, like it was just, you know, the graphics were probably worse than I expected because I didn't know what early PS2 games looked like in the first place, and then like I think the cutscenes were confusing in that game, like confusing as hell, and I didn't really know what I was doing. Like, you're supposed to time your attacks a certain way, like it's a very like rhythmic action game, and I just didn't know that.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily train you to teach you that stuff very well. I also think the first Devil May Cry is pretty hard. It's not as hard as the third one, which is also very good, but Those are really tough games, and so I assume Bayonetta would be the same way. And anyway, I just decided, okay, well, I tried this, it didn't click with me. It's Gamefly. If you don't like it on day one, you basically send it back. And so I did, and then I didn't give it much more thought. And so when Bayonetta 2 was announced, I thought, really, people are so excited for that, And anyway, so I just decided to go back and give it a fair shake. And I think with Bayonetta, it is so singular. It is such its own thing. It has such a weird, distinct personality to it that if you don't know what you're getting into, it's going to be very hard to appreciate it. But I think, especially with its second game being out now and it's getting Game of the Year awards and a lot of people are really loving it, even who didn't play the first one, just jump directly into it. I think the gaming community has sort of come around on Bayonetta to the point that I feel now that I understand what it's doing better than I did in 2009, even without even having played it before this week. And also I think that there is an acceptance for completely gonzo, wacky, bizarro Japanese games that maybe wasn't out there back in 2009. I think, and Platinum has had a lot to do with that, with stuff like Metal Gear Rising and Vanquish.
Vanquish, Jesus.
Vanquish is super fun. Super fun.
Just super weird.
Yeah. It's just Gears of War, but three times faster,
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah, it's just great. And I played Vanquish. And anyway, I've played a few games since I first tried Bayonetta that kind of made me think maybe I would like it more going back to it. And I do. So I've only played a couple hours. I wouldn't say I'm intimately familiar with the game now, but I am enjoying it a lot more than I did back that last time around. And I do think it was kind of being in the right frame of mind, not trying to understand the story, just kind of letting it wash over me and just try to enjoy it for the silliness that it is.
You say that, but by doing that, it will start to kind of, I won't say make sense, but you'll start to kind of absorb it.
I hope so. I mean, I'm totally open to that, but I'm not going to try to, pick it apart and, I'm not going to sit there and think and ponder about what are these characters' motivations and who is she really, I mean, it's whatever. It'll either sort itself out or it won't, but I'm not going to let that get in my way of playing the game. And I also think, we've discussed this in the past, but I think knowing that the point of the game is to dodge, knowing that witch time is sort of the key to playing the game, mm-hmm. and it doesn't really matter that much what combos you do. You can just sort of button mash. Now, there's more to the game than button mashing, and if you want to play in an extremely specific, stylized, skillful way, you can do that, but you don't have to. And the game's not going to punish you for not doing that. The game is much more concerned about, did you survive? How much damage did you take? How many healing items did you have to use? And you can score really well. I've gotten platinum trophies on a couple of these chapters just by using the witch time, just by dodging well. And it doesn't matter that I don't know the combos. So, right. And this is where I think the loading screens of Bayonetta actually do it a disservice, because they have this combo list kind of like in a fighting game, where you can practice your combos during the load screens. And it's this crazy, intimidating list that just seems to go on forever, and it's all just using basically two buttons, punch and kick, but in these ridiculous combinations. And it's all very tap, tap, tap. It's like, well, if I punch three times and then kick twice, it does one thing. But if I punch three times and then wait for a beat and then kick twice, it does a different move. It's like, I'm never going to learn these things, but you don't have to. You can totally ignore that crap. It's for me, playing the game is just paying attention to the enemies, trying to watch for their animations, doing the dodge at the right time, and then I just lay into it with whatever,
Right.
And it's fine.
What you're saying is true to a point. I think that later on in the game does expect you to learn the combos a little bit, at least try to get more of those hits that are more powerful than others, sometimes when your hair kind of becomes your weapon for just one hit, to punctuate a combo or something like that. The game does expect you to use at least those moves, because for some enemies, that's the only thing that's going to hurt them, or it's the only thing that's going to take away their shield.
But isn't that, aren't those moves a function of the magic meter?
So in some higher level combos do have brief appearances by like a giant hare leg kicking an enemy out of nowhere,
right?
Or like,
that's what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. But I thought those things come out if you have a lot of, if your magic is filled up. I don't get the sense that
It can happen for both. There are some combos that do end in those kinds of like a real quick appearance of that thing.
There are ways to do it always. And then sometimes you just, if you do a long combo, which will happen kind of on its own a lot of times, mm-hmm. you'll start doing that stuff even without really trying to do anything special. It'll just start to come out and it makes you feel powerful.
Right.
So anyway, there's some of the platforming in this game I think is pretty rough. Sometimes you jump on the walls and the ceiling when the moon is shining down and it looks cool, but it doesn't really feel that great. The camera swings around very wildly when you do this and it's very disorienting and confusing, especially when they put you into a scripted event. Like there's a wall of lava coming down through the street.
That part.
And you're supposed to be running away from it. It's so frustrating. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing I'm hoping Bayonetta 2 really sort of avoids.
It's better. I will say that. In some cases in Bayonetta 1, much more so than 2, there are these things that you just have to know they're coming or you're going to die.
Yeah, the quick time things.
That shit gets toned way back into. Like,
oh, thank God. Because that is the reason I stopped playing 1-for-101. It's a Kamiya thing. He loves the idea that you're playing this action game and you're doing really well. You're really kind of learning the combat system and the different kinds of enemies, and you're learning how to use your powers. And then all of a sudden, let's do a crazy dynamic cutscene that looks amazing, but with about half a second of warning, this prompt is going to come up that tells you to push a button. And if you don't push it, you die automatically.
I
don't know why
shit.
He thinks that's fun. It's not fun at all.
He's a bit of, for lack of a better word, kind of an auteurist mindset of like, this is what I want to make. I'm going to make my game. And
I wonder if the success of Bayonetta 2 might be teaching him a lesson about that.
I mean,
the fact that people like it more than the first game when he was not the director. I mean, he produced it, so he's still involved.
Oh, yeah,
but he's not the director. He's not making every single decision.
Right. I mean, he was one of a handful of people guiding the first game too. I mean, it wasn't just him, but he's the face of the company.
He was the main guy. I mean, his tombstone in that intro.
Oh, it is. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah, he gets peed on by one of the characters. it's a funny game. I mean, there's no doubt the sense of humor is great. The writing, I mean, in terms of telling some kind of cohesive story, it's not good. But in terms of being entertaining and there are some clever lines in there, and it's the voice actors sure do seem to be having a good time.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. I don't really understand what they're talking about, but they are having fun.
Bayo's voice actor rubs off
on you when you play it.
Bayo's voice actor just sounds gleeful every time she delivers this biting commentary that she spits out.
Yeah.
Like, just the shit. You can hear her shit-eating grin as she's talking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a fun style. It's a good personality for the game. So I am enjoying it a hell of a lot more than I did the last time I tried it, and I'm really glad that I went back to it and gave it another chance. Like I said, I'm going to skip ahead to Bayonetta 2 probably tonight or tomorrow, just because I want to give it full consideration before we do our list. I'm not going to finish it, but at least I'll get to experience some of it and get a sense of it. And I'm excited to do so. I'm glad. I was honestly, even getting two games for $60, I was a little bit hesitant about this purchase, and the only reason that I really went through with it all the way is just because of the crazy reviews that Bayonetta 2 is getting, and I want to see that stuff. The things that I've heard about it are such nonsense that I really want to see it for myself, and so that's why I decided to go with it. But it's nice to go back and find out that, yeah, maybe it was me. You know, I think Bayonetta has problems. I think it has some flaws and it has some things that are frustrating and really could have been avoided. But it's a good game and it is fun to play now. So I'm glad that I went back to it.
Cool.
And, you know, it's nice to have a really big, crazy looking M-rated action game on the Wii U. There's just not much else like that. And playing through it, you know, I'm not the biggest Platinum Games fan, but playing through it, it's funny to see that they are really self-reflective in their culture. Even the first Bayonetta has tons of references to Mad World and to Beautiful Joe, and you know, and I can only imagine Bayonetta 2 is just going to take that even farther.
The opening, you've played enough of Bayonetta that the opening video of Bayonetta 2 will kill you because they bring back her mobster friend, and he receives the same kind of abuse you expect him to receive, and it's. There are beat for beat jokes that they've carried over from the first game that are just that are amazingly executed.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm excited to do that. But yeah, Bayonetta is pleasant, and I know there are people who have played Bayonetta 2 and either have Bayonetta 1 and they just haven't played. I don't know if they're intending to play it, or I even heard somebody say that I think it was TYP. Maybe, who said he bought Bayonetta 2 and just hasn't bothered to go back and even pay for Bayonetta 1, even though, like, on the eShop, it's only $10 for the whole game. He's like, yeah, I don't know. But, it, you know, we talked about it, and that his discount doesn't have an expiration date, as far as we know, so he can wait if he feels like it. He can buy it whenever. But as, from what I've seen so far, I'm inclined to say, yeah, you know, even it's worth going back to. You know, if you like the second game especially, I'm sure that you'll enjoy the first one. It's a little rough around the edges, and maybe in some ways that the sequel improves upon significantly, but I still think it's fine. So with that, let's take a break, and when we come back, we've got lots more games to talk about, so stick around.
Now playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a review of a Wii U game from Brian Rose. I'm gonna let that sink in. I don't know why.
Marinate on that for a minute.
Yeah, it's because I don't want to keep reading, mostly. That review is for not two games, but when two games come together who love each other very much. It's called Block Drop Cross Twisted Fusion.
Block Drop X Twisted Fusion is what I would call it.
Japan tells me that means cross, so I'm going to go with that, because Japan's got this shit figured out.
Well, then you just ruined the joke, then.
Fine, we'll call it Block Drop X Twisted Fusion, because I haven't read ahead and don't know what the joke is.
God.
Block Drop X Twisted Fusion. It's not just a description of a series of events that lands you in the hospital as a result of illicit drug use anymore. It's probably... or using this segment. Brian provides his thoughts on this puzzle game that is incredibly difficult, but not yet. But not illegal.
I think you probably should start reading through this stuff ahead of time.
Or maybe this is how we should continue to do it, because this is what brings people to the podcast.
Man, I write this stuff every week, James. Every week you sit here and butcher it. It's like I work in a deli when I do this segment.
Make it my own. I give a flavor, a flavorfulness. To the meat.
I have a taste in my mouth and it's bad. So indeed there is a flavor there.
But is it full of flavor? Because that makes it flavorful.
It's full of something, buddy.
You're welcome. We also have a review, also on the Wii U, but by Zach Miller. Shantae and the Pirate's Curse. Zach is a huge fan of the Shantae series, and lets you know if it's worth double dipping for those that already have this on 3DS. He also evaluates pixels, and if there's anybody that's gonna be staring at this game close up, it's Zach Miller. Which is to say, John's talking about the fact that he's looking at the boobs in this game. Of which there are, well, there's two per character, but they are voluptuous, will be the word I would use for it. And well animated.
Because if you're gonna go, just go the whole way.
Sure. All right, and we have a review of Chariot for the Wii U by Neil Ronahan. Neil gives his verdict on this colorful 3D platformer that sees you dragging around the coffin of a dead king. It reminds me of RFN. We've been dragging around James's dead soul for years, and it's a game we can't turn off.
You know, sometimes when my soul dies, it comes back and manifests during this segment. So, I'm going to go ahead and call this segment Haunted, and we'll proceed.
And we have a review of Underground for Wii U by Don Koopman. Don takes a break from his typical
who's
diet.
Who's that about butchering?
Don takes a break from his typical diet of mind-shatteringly bad games to play one that's actually pretty good, at least by his own admission. Though, to a starving man, rotten meat is like caviar, as they say. Actually, they don't say that. I just made that up. It's a pretty terrible saying.
Yeah. All this and way less incomprehensible babble can be yours. Just yours. We've been doing this just for you. Nobody else. But don't tell that guy. Let him feel special. But just for you, listening to this right now, all one listener who made it through this segment is yours at NintendoWorldReport.com.
And we are back with more games. So let's kick it back to John. And John, I heard that you recently visited a Nintendo museum.
Well, I'll kind of wrap this into one whole sort of story. You know, I went back to my mom's place for the holidays, of course, and I was there for quite a while. Usually I'm only in there for 3 or 4 days, so I don't have a lot of time to actually kind of mull about and you know, kind of go through all my stuff that's still there. But I was there for about a week this time, so I was able to kind of, like, you know, get some stuff ready, because, you know, there's stuff I'm selling on eBay and this, that, and the other, but, you know, a lot of that, like, old toys and stuff like that, which is worth money, but I gotta sell it, so. But of course, I have what you would call, the thing is, I have a quandary. So, I have a lot of old Nintendo stuff at my mom's place in really, really good shape, in boxes, right? Like, I have my original NES in the box. I mean, everything's in really good shape. It has this, now this, the one I bought was the one with the, if anybody remembers, it had the player's guide in it. It didn't come with a game. It came with the player's guide. And yeah, this was one that was, it came out shortly after launch, after the NES had been on the market for maybe a year, 2 years or so. I think I got it in about 87. So maybe it had been on the market for about 2 years.
So it was still a Grey Gun then too, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So, yeah.
So what is the player's guide, by the way? Because I think a lot of people don't know what that is.
Yeah, the player's guide is a soft cover, kind of like a strategy guide for all of the games at the time, like a lot of the NES games, a lot of that early first wave of NES games. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it has all maps, all the maps in it, everything that you would, it's very Nintendo Power-ish, except it's in a soft cover format.
And it's like 80 or 90 games in there, right?
Oh yeah, it's big.
It's huge. Yeah.
It's a pretty big book. But yeah, so there's that. So my NES, I mean, I'm sure it still works. I mean, those things actually, they don't die if you actually take care of them. I think I have that, and the games I have for it, I believe, are Super Mario Bros. 2, Castlevania, Blaster Master. All of these are in the boxes, and they're in great shape. And maybe one more I can't think of. And then I also have my Super NES is there, still in the box, all that kind of stuff. So it's sitting there, and I have it, for my NES, I also have an NES Advantage joystick.
Nice.
The big arcade joystick. So my quandary is, right, the thing is with this stuff, right, I'm going to have to move it at some point, you know. My mom's getting up there. At some point, I'm going to have to take care of this stuff, so what to do with it? Should I sell it? I put it to you guys. What do you think I should do with this? Should I sell it or just keep it forever?
So I'm looking at an NES entertainment system that came with the player's guide.
Mm-hmm.
This one also came with the control deck. Is that same as yours?
The control deck is what they actually called the NES console, right?
Right.
Oh, is that okay.
The control deck is the VCR like part of the NES.
Yeah. Gotcha. It's listed on eBay as a buy it now for $209, but that's not being met. So I would guess you could probably unload it for $130, but I see the books online for about $15-$20, so it's really the box is what's the value here.
Yeah.
So it depends on the quality of your box. My argument would be the book itself is cool.
Yeah.
That thing would be awesome, like as a coffee table book,
I'm looking at scans of the book. It's pretty, I mean, it's like a proto Nintendo Power.
Yeah, it is. Yep.
But it's got tons of games in it. So it is kind of an interesting piece. The thing is, I don't know that having an original NES right now makes a lot of sense, even if you have a lot of original NES games, because there are these, you know, NES, I'm gonna call them Famiclones because they're not, but there are more modern repros that are gonna give you a better experience.
Because the patent expired on it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you even want to go the physical route,
right? If that matters to you, mm-hmm. it's the most authentic experience, but it's not going to be the best experience for you as a player.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the thing, right? I mean, at this point, stuff is, you know, the stuff that you can download is starting to outstrip the quality of what you would actually get from playing it on the NES.
Oh no, it did from day one. I mean,
in a lot of ways. But John, I guess my feeling on it would be. Does it have sentimental value to you?
Oh, I mean, that's unquestionable, man.
I mean, this particular...
Of course, that's how I get myself into this.
Right, but like, if you sold this one and then bought a cheaper NES off eBay or at a flea market, would that feel like a major downgrade to you? And it sounds like yes.
I would not buy another one. Either I keep this one or buy another one.
But you said you have another one, right?
No, I don't.
Oh, so no. You'd bought a second one.
So to me, the reason to sell it would be if you were trying to upgrade to something like the top loader NES, which is going to cost you, I think, more than your system is worth by a lot.
Yeah. Yep.
So you'd have to throw in some cash to boost that. But if you really want to keep if you don't care which particular NES, I mean, this one you grew up with, this was part of your home. So
absolutely.
It has some sentimental value. If you can set that aside, and if you really just care about the archival quality, you know, like having a system that will work forever that you can always go back and plug a cartridge into and play, then it might be worth trying to go out and get either one of the really high quality repros like James suggested, or Nintendo's own repro, which was that top loader NES, but those are super expensive.
You know what? I'm actually seeing those dropping in price a little bit.
I'm seeing my old NES is jacked. It is not in working condition,
I'm seeing them run complete, no box, but just complete hardware for about $100.
Oh, man, I might go buy one of those. That's great. Wow.
Yep.
Okay. I thought they were like more than that.
They were. I recall them being considerably more expensive than that. But you can get a Retro Duo, which does Super Nintendo and Nintendo and Famicom games, if you have any, for like $59.
Yeah, I know.
And those will have the hookups you need, as opposed to having to get like an RF adapter or something nuts like that.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know. Like, this is all if you actually plan on playing the thing, and
that's not sure. That's my point.
Right.
Yeah.
Point. This thing has been sitting in a closet literally for 15 years.
And you move around a lot, and like maybe you'll keep doing that, maybe not. But I don't know. If you're going to bring this back with you, and if you're going to put it, like, if you're going to have to rent storage space for it and never see it, like, I don't understand that. Like, some people do that, but I wouldn't do it. Like, it seems like a waste of cash.
It's not valuable enough to hold it in escrow.
Right.
Yep.
And John, I know your apartment is not humongous, so you probably need to think about, like, if you did bring that back with you or shipped it to yourself back in California, what would you do with it? I mean, would you have that hooked up? Would you have a retro gaming corner? You know, you buy an old CRT and put it in a different room and that becomes your sort of gaming retro mecca. Because if you're not going to do that, then maybe it's not worth keeping.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm going with it, is The fact that probably if I wanted to play the three NES games that I have for it, I mean, definitely I could play them in more convenient ways than I'm doing so right now.
Sure. You can always go buy more cartridges, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Those are becoming pretty expensive too.
Yeah. Some of them are.
And it's more stuff to store as well. You know, it's just, it's just decluttering. It's decluttering is what I'm trying to do. But I see these things and I'm like, man, damn.
Then again, you know, if you think about it, John, just by opening that box, just by looking at it and touching it and talking about it with your friends like you are now, you're probably getting most of the value that remains in that hardware for you.
Yeah.
Because you putting in those games, that is not like a much needed service for you. Like, you have ways of playing those games if you really want to. And you do sometimes.
Yep.
But, you know, the sentimental value is, hey, I remember, it's just bringing back those memories, and you're not going to be doing that on a weekly or a monthly basis, right? So, I mean, that's exactly. Almost like a one-time thing. It's just, like you said, it's been sitting in a closet for 15 years. Yep. You can only have that experience of seeing it 15 years later, maybe once or twice,
mm-hmm.
right? And you've already done it.
Yep, yep. So, yeah.
There is something undeniable about holding the original controller in all its incredible discomfort.
Yeah.
those little edges and corners. Hands.
You should just keep the controller, like cut off the cord and like carry it in your pockets or something. Thumb it, you know, just like caress it when you feel like you need that shot of Nintendo nostalgia.
It's like,
give yourself a blister anytime you want
to. I need my hands to feel really uncomfortable. There we go.
Yeah. Oh, the light has gone out. The light has gone out.
Oh, I love how much this button mushes.
Yeah.
Actually, what you should do, John, or somebody should do this, is make a line of keychains that are made from old NES D-pads, so that you can just reach into your pocket and give yourself a blister anytime you want, just to remind you of the good old days.
And the D-pad was the best part of that fucking controller. Like, the face buttons are sponges, the edges are sharp, the corners stick in your hands, there's no ergonomics to speak of. The D-pad's the only thing that's even fucking functionally marginal.
This is why we all love the Super Nintendo controller so much, because it was a massive upgrade over
the buttons still aren't totally there yet.
They're a lot better, though.
It's really the N64 is where you thought, oh, these buttons feel good. Like, they have a nice click to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of my quandary with those guys. So I'm going to get them shipped down here. I think I'm going to get my mom to ship them down here, and then and we'll see what happens. So I'll have a day of reckoning.
Yeah. I'm sure you'll get some feedback from the listeners on what you should do with all this.
Yeah, they'll say, you should put it on eBay.
Exactly. They'll be like, put it on eBay, and we'll bid it up. Thanks.
So, John,
thanks,
did you
guys.
Play Final
Who
Fantasy?
Who paid $47 million for my NES? God damn it.
As a matter of fact... Yes, I did play Final Fantasy VI. And I, you know, on Twitter...
Well, did you play it on your old Super Nintendo?
No. No, of course. I played it on my Vita so I can carry it around. That's my point. That's the thing. I can now play these games like you just said. I have so many ways.
You're a child of the future.
I am.
You ain't got time for that old stuff.
But he's got time for a fucking Vita!
I still... What?
A second Vita! Jesus.
The Vita is the future.
Well, it should have been my only Vita.
The future of what?
But yeah,
Sony having to sell another office?
The future of emulation.
Okay, well, that case.
Yeah, I'm playing emulated Nintendo games on it, effectively. What does that tell you?
It tells me it's the PSP 2.
Wait. Are you playing the PS1 version that you can buy off? Okay, But that sucks, right? Oh, like, it's got these load times that the Vita doesn't fix.
I mean, I don't think the Vita really changes anything.
I mean, the mechanics of the loading will be faster because it's not loading them off the damn disc. But
yeah, it's not bad though. I mean, there's nothing that I've seen that's particularly over long in terms of loading. But it just has the awful cutscenes.
Oh, now, this isn't your first time playing Final Fantasy VI, is it?
Oh, no.
Okay.
Nope.
Good.
But, yeah, you know, it was interesting because it struck me like a lightning bolt from the heavens that I really do enjoy this game a lot more than Chrono Trigger. And I don't know if that's just a product of... I really wish one of my regrets in my life, if you could cue the sad music...
Is that you're not playing really. Chrono Cross? I understand.
Is that I didn't play Chrono Trigger when it was actually contemporary.
No, you played it when it was contemporary on the DS for like 6.5 years.
Yeah, it's not the same though. I mean, it's not because I don't know if I would feel the same way about Final Fantasy VI if I was playing it right now.
You wouldn't.
Right. Right.
I mean, I played that game. I played that game in 2002, and you wouldn't feel the same because RPGs had gotten significantly better at that point.
Yeah.
And people could be like, "What do you mean better?" Well, I mean, like they'd become more complex, and you could do more with them.
Mm-hmm. I don't think complex is necessarily better. But...
Well, I mean, in ways that it does make it better. It makes it more. There's more to it. You can have more. Strategy and development going on to it.
So, John, I'm curious if you can go into some detail about why you think FF6 is better, because as you know, and I think a lot of people know, these are my two favorite games ever. And
yeah,
they're similar in a lot of ways. They're made by some of the same people. They came out pretty close to each other in time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet in a lot of ways they're very different and they have very different styles. And for a long time I kind of went back and forth on which one I liked better.
Yeah.
And over time, as I got older and I played other games, I kind of went back to Chrono Trigger and said, this one clicks for me a little bit more. And I could go into it, but I'm really just really curious about what you think about it.
Well, I think I like the setting more. Really, it's more like a traditional RPG setting, right?
Except in many ways, it's got all the mech stuff. It's like
steampunky. I like that.
But that was not really the norm back then. Like I don't really recall that kind of universe being Japanese RPGs very much.
Yeah, it was striking. The color palette was crazy when it first came out. We were all like, "What is this? It's so brown and gray and gritty looking, and I'd never seen a game that looked
so
like that."
So there was some of that, but it wasn't Square doing it ultimately. Square, I mean, for what they were, it was sort of traditional in their approach to making those games. So when they did it, when they went and made a game like that, it was the first time most people had seen it. So
they sort of
got to pretend to be, you know, we're going out there on the limb, but it's.
It was a major shift for that particular franchise.
Absolutely.
Major.
Yeah, it was much darker than anything that had come before, I think. Mm-hmm. Which maybe is because maybe that's why I like it. But really, I think what I like about
it's a gritty game for a gritty man like you.
It is.
It's for serious gamers.
It is. I knew that was coming. I was going to tweet that at some point.
I tried to stop myself from saying it, and I just couldn't resist.
I mean, let's just take the logical conclusion. It's mature games for overly mature men like John.
That's going to be on my tombstone, Johnny. You realize that, right?
It's like 2 or 3 years from now is what you're telling us.
It's going to be death is a serious game for serious gamers. That's going to be on my tombstone. Yeah, but I just like it because it seems to throw a lot of stuff at you that you don't expect and that really are kind of out of character for RPGs for the most part. Just really wild stuff. Like I was playing the area that I'm at right now is I'm on I just beat the Phantom Train, which is just sort of so out of nowhere. You're going through this kind of haunted wood and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, hey, there's a train here. And you're like, what? I mean, and I know that with other RPGs, I mean, they're as weird as hell. So, but I don't know. It just seems like it's less straightforward than Chrono Trigger is. Chrono Trigger just seemed really. I mean, yeah, it switched times, but it was never. I don't know. It didn't surprise me as much, I guess. And
Chrono Trigger for a game that, you know, it's about time travel, so it's sort of, you know, it's hard to imagine that it's linear, but there's a simplicity to Chrono Trigger that I think is very deliberate, and it is straightforward in a way that in my old age I find more appealing than the relative complexity of FF6.
In a way, it reminds very heavily of, you know, the work of Akira Toriyama, who made the art for that game. You know, it's very much kind of like this easily digestible kind of like every character in that is fairly simple. There's, you know, everybody has kind of a quick character arc where they become, they overcome their own personal challenge and all come together to beat the big boss at the end.
Yeah.
It's very shiny, happy, good times. And,
and yeah, like Chrono Trigger has a, what really struck me at the time, a really small world map. You know, like you can get around the continents in, you know, a couple of seconds. Like it's, Yeah, like you spend most of your time in areas within that world map, but like it's just like these like three or four continents, and then you visit them in several eras, and you know, like the landscape changes a bit. But
yeah, that's the cool thing there, is that it's a small map, but it's different in every time period, and so ultimately there's still a lot to explore. Right. Whereas FF6 still has two world maps, but you can't go back and forth between them. That's still the best. Maybe the single best moment in gaming is when you wake up and realize that the world really was destroyed and it is totally different and it will never go back to the way it was before. And a lot of the people that you knew from before, a lot of the places that you knew are gone. Mm-hmm. And it's an emotional moment in FF6 that I don't know of any other game that really pulls it off the same way. It's incredible. And then they make you play in that world, in that sort of depressing, morose world. Yep. For many hours, you know? I mean, it is more than half of the game.
Yeah, and I mean, there's stuff like that. I think that's what attracts me more to it than anything else, is the fact that there's so many times when you expect them to zig, and they just completely zag. Mm-hmm. You expect them to just go the typical RPG route, and they're like, no, we're not doing that. That character that you just kind of started to like, he's just going to leave your party, and he's not even going to tell you why. You're like, what? Wait a minute. I just gave that guy armor and weapons, and I just powered him up. What the fuck? What are you doing, game? What's going on? And so that kind of stuff, it's like you sort of learn to expect the unexpected, which is what I like about it. And you know, you can choose different paths to take. Like, you know, you can choose to view one character's story, and then you play through their little story arc, and then you come back and you play through the other story arc. And it's just, I like that concept that it's a sprawling world in which you're very aware of multiple things going on at once, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
Like, it's not just like, you are the hero marching forward, and you go to point A, B, C, D, E, and F, and then that's the end of the game.
It's not even totally clear who is the main character in FF6.
Yeah.
The game deliberately confuses that issue. And the two most likely candidates as main character in that game are both women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a landmark. Yeah, that don't even step to the forefront until, you know, a while into the game. Like,
yeah.
So there's, I don't know. I think it's that element of surprise, and the fact that even to this day, I play that game and I'm like, what the hell? What are they doing? This doesn't make any sense. I'm looking for a trope here. I'm finding nothing.
Mm.
So,
it's also like arguably the best looking Super Nintendo game.
Yeah.
It's way up there. That game just looks and it sounds totally incredible.
Yeah. Now, I saw it criticized on Twitter in the fact that, you know, of course, you know, there's, what, 20 different endings for Chrono Trigger, so...
Mm-hmm.
But, how do you feel... A lot of them are, you know, it's very similar.
Yeah. There's a lot of gimmicks and there's a lot of joke endings and, you know, things like that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, but do you think that gives legitimate replay value?
The different endings, not in themselves, to me, they're kind of a byproduct of the new game plus. And that's something that Chrono Trigger doesn't always get credit for. But as far as I know, that game basically invented new game plus for Japanese RPGs. It's certainly the first time I'd ever seen it. And playing through the game the second time, there is a lot of stuff that you either cannot possibly get to the first time through, or you just wouldn't know to even try.
Yep.
And going through it the second time, when you're way more powerful and you can do things out of order and you can, you know, you can beat bosses very easily, but they add in, there's just a ton of optional stuff in that game that you just will not find the first time through. And so playing it on New Game Plus ends up being a really different experience. And then at the end, what you'll find is that, oh, and I also got a different ending that's really, in some ways, very different. And then you start reading about all the weird, you know, there's the ending where everyone turns into a dinosaur. I mean, there's just lots of crazy, bizarre things like that.
Yeah.
So, I did that once. Chrono Trigger is imminently replayable. I think the alternate endings are kind of a shorthand that people use when they're talking about just how replayable that game is, but they're not really the main reason to play through it more than once. You play through Chrono Trigger more than once because the game is different every time you play through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I you know, back in the day, I think it was my only only RPG on the Super Nintendo. So I replayed it because I had lots of free time, because I liked the game. And also, like, the fact that the game takes maybe like 30, 35 hours, you know, to get through
on
the
new game
first
plus
time.
It's less than that.
Yeah, exactly. So the first time it takes maybe 35 hours if you take your time. Maybe more if you're John, but whatever. And then, like, the subsequent times, like, it's just going to be faster and faster. So you can just, take shortcuts. And, so yeah, that does help the replay value more than just seeing what the new endings are. And today, like, you can just, like, look up on YouTube, I'm sure, what the new the other endings are. And, well, you know, I don't think they're the point.
Right, right.
You replay
the fun thing about New Game Plus is getting a rainbow shell for every member of your party, and, you know, feeding every character magic tabs and speed tabs until all their stats are maxed out. And you can, I got to where I was counting how many bosses could I get through in the game before it took me two hits to kill one. And the farthest I ever made it was, I think, that the first big machine boss when you go to the future, to the far future, which is, you know, it's decently far. It's like the third time era that you go to, and up to then, every single boss that I fought, I could kill in one hit.
That's awesome.
I abused that game. I mean, I think I had a New Game Plus file on there that I had played through seven times consecutively.
Man.
Yeah. Carrying over every time, just rolling over my characters every single time. So I had all the best gear on every single character.
I've seen all the endings.
Yeah.
So yeah, I went through the game a lot.
I think my favorite is the balloon ending.
Yeah, that's one of the regular endings that you can get. Like, I mean, like, because when you first go through the game, you can only get three possible endings, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of them. It's if you crash your ship, the Epoch, into Lavos, blah, 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 whatever, the bad guy, and so you're, you know, without a time machine, Yeah, no, it's a nice and kind of like with a bittersweet music. It's just thinking about
it. That's
the best game ever.
It gives me chills.
Yeah, the bittersweet music.
Anyway, they're both amazing, and if you haven't played both of those games, I strongly recommend that you go play both of them.
Stop listening to this podcast right now and just go play them.
The fuck are you doing with your life if you haven't played Chrono Trigger and FF6?
Yeah.
All right. Yep. Well, let's move on then to Guillaume.
Yeah. So, okay, I'm gonna try to talk about several games at once. Johnny, you've talked about Shantae in episode 4 or 3, and I think you did a good job describing it. And you've talked about Captain Toad a couple of episodes ago. So I've finished Shantae, found all the items. I pretty much know what the game's about.
Which version?
Oh, Shantae Pirate's Curse. Sorry, on the Wii U. On the Wii U.
Okay, so you played the new Wii U version.
Right, which is essentially the same. It's got, like, the pixel art graphics and everything. They do have kind of HD portraits when the characters are talking. Instead of having, like you mentioned, a character having, like, boobs in 3D.
3D boobs. Yeah.
So I don't get that. And
instead,
I'm kind
you get
of thankful.
HD boobs.
I get the HD boobs, which made... I had to be careful not to talk to any female character in town when, like, the little nieces were running around when I was playing at home. But yeah, anyway, so the point is I've played through Shantae, and I'm currently going through Captain Toad. I'm in, like, Chapter 3. I think I'm pretty far. There are still chances that the game might surprise me, but so far, I guess what I want to say is that both these games are excellent, and I've been having great time with them, and I think, like, you know, they both look spectacular in their own way. Like, they all, and they're both, like, Shantae is fucking hilarious. Like, the dialogue is you know, breaks the fourth wall constantly, but in a way that's actually funny and not, you know, kind of edgy or grating or annoying. So I'm really enjoying that way more than I expected. And Captain Toad just makes me laugh. Like, I can watch Toadette. Like, there's this one animation where it's zoomed in on her face and she's confused, looking left and right, and then stares at the screen with this big, stupid smile. And I crack up every time. like, both these games are kind of, they're very much in, you know, in my wheelhouse. They're very much games that, in genres that I love, and they're executed superbly. But I kind of want to try to articulate why exactly they're probably not going to be like amongst on my list of like my favorite games ever. And it's just because, like, even though these games have been developed by people who know what they're doing and who are really, you know, really, who have mastered their craft, like, I feel like neither of them is really surprising in any way. Hmm. You know, like, sometimes you play a game and it's, you know, a genre that you love, and it just feels great when you discover something, you figure something out, and you feel clever. And I'm not really feeling that as much as I'm getting the feeling that, oh, these people, they've played the same games that I have, you know?
So, like, I mean, when I play a WayForward game, I can't shake the omnipresent feeling that I'm playing somebody's fan game. A very well-made fan game, but it's always like, I feel like I've done this before.
Right. So I think that in this case, like, I think that Pirate's Curse is leagues better than anything else that I've played from them. I think yes. that the execution is just much better than I've ever seen. Like, Risky's Revenge was nowhere near this good, in my opinion. Yep. But at the same time, yeah, like, I it does feel like they've played a lot of Metroid, a lot of, you know, the Castlevania that are more like Metroid in structure. It feels like they've been making this type of game for a long time, and it feels like I've played all of them, you know?
It's funny, because we talk about what made Shovel Knight feel so different than those games. And I think it's the feeling of that game really built on those same kind of concepts that previous games had, but it did its own thing. So it feels like it had its, in a way, it almost feels more of the time that these kinds of games originated, because it feels like somebody played one of those games and went and iterated on it right away.
Well, also, Shovel Knight pulls back so much on the story and character stuff and the sort of adventure-y running around town stuff. I mean, it has that, but it's dispensed with very quickly. It's very functional and it doesn't take up much of your time. Whereas in Shantae, that's a lot of the, you know, people like Zach Miller who love Shantae and have always loved it. That's why they play those games. They want the big character portraits. They want the goofy dialogue. They want to run around in town and talk to all the characters. Whereas I'm like, just give me the thing that I need so I can go to the next level. And Shovel Knight lets you just go to the next level. It's much more pure and straightforward and just action-packed. I think that's a lot of why it feels different.
I mean, in a way, it feels older than the Shantae games. I mean, technically speaking, it is. But right. It also feels fresher at the same time, which is a hard thing to wrap my head around.
Yeah, maybe I need to go back to Shovel Knight, because I did not get... I felt it was a good game, but I don't know.
I mean, your mileage may vary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like, Shantae, so that's that. Like, it's very Metroid-like, and I feel like the things that are hidden in places where I expect to find them, which in a way is great, but in another way is kind of like, well, they might as well not be hidden at all, you know?
It's almost a letdown. You're like, right. I hope there's an item here. Of course there was an item there. God damn it.
Yeah, yeah. And Captain Toad is kind of in the same way, you know? Like, there are some elements of Mario games, which, of course, I'm very familiar with, and there are many elements of similar puzzle games, which, like, none come up in my head at the moment, but like games where the hero is very much underpowered and has to rely on the environment to dispatch enemies, or has to rely on enemies actually killing each other. You know, like you steer them towards each other and you let them eliminate themselves. And things like, you know, like he can't jump, and there are many puzzle games where you can't jump and you just have to figure out how do I get up there so I can fall in the right spot to get to this place and then, you know, continue on. So yeah, like again, like the game is very much in my wheelhouse. It's funny. It's everything that I like about, you know, video games. But at the same time, there's no sense of surprise. Like I feel like I've manipulated the camera in a game in the same way before to uncover some area. And, you know, it's not that like, oh, I can guess what the levels are before I even see them. Like, it's not like I'm not prescient. Like, it's not, you know, it's kind of a more subtle feeling, you know, like it's kind of, yeah, the feeling that these guys went to school, like to level design, you know, had a level design crash course by Miyamoto, and turns out that, you know, they didn't add anything else to the game, or they didn't really.
So,
like, it's kind of a slightly different flavor of something that I've had before.
Yeah, so it's perfunctory.
When I have these kinds of that kind of mental like feeling of like I've been here before, I kind of like to try to trace out the games that I'm really getting that vibration from, and like what game in the past is resonating on me. And hearing you talk about a little bit about this game and understanding a little bit how Captain Toad works, the one that kind of pops out to me in a way is what was it, the Mario RPG on the Wii.
I still haven't played that.
Super Paper Mario.
Manipulating the world to kind of find all these hidden places, but they're always felt like they're exactly where you would expect them to be.
Like, right. Yeah. Super Paper Mario is a very flawed game. It has severe pacing problems that Captain Toad complete. I mean, well, Captain Toad and is that's not much the part, better paced.
That's not the
than
part
Super
that
Paper
I'm.
Mario.
That's not the part that's. I'm kind of hitting on. It's when you're out in the world and you're like, hey, I should rotate the camera here. Oh, there's a thing. It's kind of like there's a little bit of that there. When I think of the falling through the environment and making enemies do things that I can't hurt them, I'm thinking more towards like Zelda dungeons where you'd have to it shows up a lot in the most recent one, Link Between Worlds, where there's all these enemies you have to kind of force to kill themselves.
Right.
Where you have to kind of fall into the right hole to land where
That's
you need
true.
To be.
Yeah, there's a lot of Zelda and Captain Toad, I find. Just in the way that you have to figure out how to get to the higher levels to then, you know, uncover some new route in the lower levels and, you know.
Or to just fall in the right spot, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, like, I just want to stress that, like, both these games are pretty amazingly put together, and I am enjoying them. Like, I'm not, you know, bored out of my mind, and I'm not feeling like I'm kind of wasting my time or going through the motions, you know? Like, it's saying that, like, these are paint by numbers would be way too harsh.
Sure.
But at the same time, and I do think that they've got sound design principles behind them. Like, I don't know if you were a long time ago, I think it was episode 301. I talked about I've got my list here. So episode 340, I talked about Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon and Wario Land 2 and how both of these games had secrets that just felt arbitrary, you know. And these games, Shantae and Captain Toad, don't have that. Like, they've got all the hints in place to, you know, steer you in the right direction. And I think that's good, right?
But it can also, when you play a game like that where the secrets are in, they're always in the most logical place, you know, like they're in the place where the perfect game design would put them.
Right.
When you play it, if you're someone who has a lot of experience playing similar games, it can feel a little bit like you're just kind of following the recipe. You know what I
right.
mean? It lacks a sense of discovery because the game is just so solidly designed that it feels like it's following a formula a little bit.
Right. But I do think it's better, like this kind of thing is much better than having like, okay, there are 10 walls in Wario Land 2 or there are 10 curtains in Luigi's Mansion. and there's like coins hidden between wall or curtain 3 and 5, but they're all identical, and you're going to have to vacuum or dash into all these curtains or walls. Wow, it's hard to talk about two games at the same time. But anyway, you know, like I had the same feeling from both. Like, it's kind of arbitrary. There are two of these things like that hide some secrets, but you're going to have to bash into all of them. You're going to have to try them all before you find these coins. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's good design. I think it kind of wastes the player's time, and it rewards kind of going through the motions more than actually having to figure something out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, like, and I'm trying to think of the last game that made me think, okay, this is a familiar kind of game, and I like it in a genre that I love, and it's also surprising and fresh, and I'm coming up with Fez.
You know? Oh, yeah, Fez is a good one. There's right. another game I can think of that's actually on Wii U, but I'm probably going to talk about it next week. Hmm. So I kind of don't want to say anything right now.
Cool. Well,
but they're out
the ladder.
Yes, the ladder.
Anyway, I just you know, like I was kind of going through this this you know argument that I'm going through right now on Twitter with someone. I hope that I manage to articulate why I think that both these games are great. You know, like they're not totally doing it for me, and that's the reason why there's not enough surprise. Like it's kind of it's yeah. all familiar.
Yeah, it's comfort food, but
yeah, which can be good. But
mm-hmm. yeah, sometimes it's exactly what you need. Mm-hmm. So James didn't have any other new business, and my wrap up will not take very long because it's really just Smash Brothers. So last weekend, right after I moved to Las Vegas, TYP came to visit. Since he's from LA area, he has been to Vegas many times throughout his life, and he sort of came to show me around town, which is invaluable. It was really great. So we ate a lot of good restaurants and went around and did some fun stuff, and we played some video games once I got my apartment set up a little bit. We played some Mario Kart, and you know, we did some of the things that you would probably expect, but the nicest part, I think the best part of playing games with him was that TYP and I have been playing Smash Brothers together since 2001, I think. We probably played Melee together at E3 that year before the GameCube even launched. So we go way back on Smash Brothers, and I feel like we have always been really evenly matched. And whenever he would come visit in Colorado, or whenever I would go out to see his place in California, we always make time to play Smash Brothers, and it's always so much fun because I think we have really the same approach. We both like to play random characters. We're both in it for the lols, and we're both good, but kind of in a general sense, you know, like we don't have really common patterns. We don't have certain characters that we just mastered or anything like that. We're both kind of just overall players and very similarly matched. And so we always have a ton of fun playing against each other. We just don't get to do it that often. I am hoping that we'll get a chance to do it more regularly, not only because we now live 4 hours away from each other, which is much closer than ever before, but also just because we now have a game that we can play online effectively. So I'm hoping to be doing that more with him. But we played locally here, and in addition to a lot of smashing and checking out some of the levels that we hadn't spent as much time with, we played the two-player event mode, and we were pretty curious to check that out because they are unique events. It's surprisingly difficult to get into. I didn't even think about it, but you have to go to group instead of solo, and then choose events. And that's how you play the two-player event mode, and they're all unique events. Now, a lot of them are basically the same as the single player, except now there's more characters on the screen. But there are some that are different as well. And so we played through maybe about half of the events. There were a few branches that we just kind of gave up on. You know, there's like the one where you're on the Star Fox level and the Mr. Game & Watches are falling from the sky and you can't let them touch the ground. And that one really annoyed me in single player. And I finally got through it. I'm not that good with Fox, you know, and I don't really like his his aerial attack for the kind of specificity and accuracy that they're forcing you to do in that event. I mean, that's what makes it challenging, but having two people on the screen really didn't make that any easier. And that was sort of the pattern that we found, is that in a lot of cases, having two players really, I mean, they're not the same events, but they're, a lot of them remind you of ones that you played by yourself. And in a lot of cases, they feel actually more difficult with two people. Either because the game throws more enemies at you to deal with, or just because there's more chaos on the screen when you have an extra person playing. And, you know, much like in the single player events, they force you to play with certain characters. Except a lot of times in here, for the stage that I described before, player one is still playing Fox, but player two is playing Falcon.
Right.
Falco. And you know, and sometimes the extra characters that they load you up with aren't the ones you like, or they're not even very compatible strategy wise with the first character or whatever. You know, I mean, there are various levels of difficulty that they're trying to arrange, but ultimately, I think it's a fun mode. I'm really glad that it exists and that there, you know, it's a whole bunch of extra content that I hadn't got to play at all yet, because you can only do it locally with two people. And so it gave us something productive to do, you know, and I was unlocking trophies and coins and stuff going through it. But what I found is that, you know, the event mode is structured such that a lot of these things are pretty difficult. And that tradition goes back to Melee, you know, where a lot of the events were really, really hard. And you're expected to kind of beat your head against them for a long time. You're supposed to try it over and over and over until you finally figure out some way of doing it. And that's part of the fun of that mode. But when you're playing with two people trying to do it,
it's kind of a nightmare.
You have to both have the patience to get through that. And sometimes one person's like, I can't do that one anymore. And so you just go do something different.
Yeah, Karen and I, like, we couldn't play that mode for too long, especially the stage that you described with the parachuting Game & Watch, man.
It's hellish.
It is, and like when one of you misses, like you feel so bad because, oh shit, I've just let the other person down.
I've ruined this for both of us.
Yeah, and then the other person messes up when you don't. Mm-hmm. It's the worst feeling ever.
So, I mean, I've only played the single player version of that, and it's miserable.
It's
fucking miserable. I can't imagine with two people.
It's just as bad.
They compensate. I'm sure they by hitting you with more Game & Watches.
Oh, yeah.
Fuck that stage. It's the last one I beat. It's the final. Fuck that.
You know, and we only sat down for basically one session, and we made it through a lot of events. So it's the kind of thing that, you know, if we hang out more, maybe we'll go back to it. Maybe we'll get through some of the ones that we got stuck on. But it's harder to just keep going back and trying it over and over and over and over again, which is sort of what you have to do in events mode when you have two people, because then you both have to be on board for that. And if either one of you just kind of gets to the tipping point and says, I just can't do this anymore, then the other person has no choice but to give up and go do something different. And so the social dynamic of playing events with two people was not really quite what I expected. It's good content. I'm glad that stuff is in there. And just speaking as I think hopefully all of our listeners are aware, 2IP is, you know, the host of Radio Trivia. He's a video game music guru. When you hang out with 2IP, you will listen to video game music. It's just going to happen. He's going to have it. That's what he listens to most of the time. And then I got the idea, hey, I haven't messed around with my music at all in Smash Brothers. I just haven't sat down to take the time to do it. I said, hey, Mike, would you be willing to go through and kind of set me up a little bit? And he's like, yeah, sure. And he spent maybe 30 minutes going through and just sort of customizing my playlist for me.
I hope he set you up for live and learn every time you get Sonic.
we spent some time discussing. I gave him some notes on the Sonic level because some of those songs are...
Did you just say, can you set it to no songs play? Is that possible?
Yeah, they're not fit for human consumption, some of those songs. There's a song from Sonic the Hedgehog 2006 in Smash Brothers for Wii U.
Oh, there is, yeah. And what's funny is there are characters who are mentioned who are... There's a trophy for a character that exists solely in a, or it's the white one that shows up in 06, Silver. Like, it just says Sonic the Hedgehog as the game it's from, and no systems are mentioned. It's just like...
Yep, yep.
Oh.
So anyway, Smash Brothers for Wii U continues to be pretty stellar. Pretty amazing stuff. And this was really my first chance playing a good chunk of it in local multiplayer. And, you know, I'm a big fan of the online mode, and I'm really glad that it more or less works the way you want it to this time. But, playing it, with a friend locally, it was awesome. And I'm really glad I got to do that before this end of the year list that we're going to do next week, because I think it probably gave me a new perspective on that game.
Well, John and I can do an online mode that'll give you a new perspective on the game too.
Oh, indeed we can.
Well, maybe we need to make plans to do that this weekend. All right. Well, anyway, that's going to wrap up my new business and the episode itself. But I have a lot of business to take care of here before we go out, and I'm going to try to do it in a hurry.
Sorry. Yeah. I need to say this before the episode is over. I just thought finally of phrasing what I wanted to say with Captain Toad and Shantae. Both games gave me what I wanted, but neither gave me what I didn't know I wanted.
Oh. Perfect.
There you go.
Nicely done. Okay. Well, in wrapping up the show, I do want to remind everyone to send in their emails. You know, we had a great crop of them last week. We may try to do some next week, along with maybe next week will just be our top fives and emails, if things work out that way. But anyway, you can send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. It never changes. Some people have been asking about Retroactive, and I really want to do another one. It has been quite a while since we did a Retroactive, and that's not by intention. It's just kind of the way things worked out. And I think this time of year, especially once we finish that top five task that we do every time, this is a really good time of year, because there really aren't new games coming out very much. It's a good time to go back and play something that we missed or play an older game. So if you, the listeners, have any ideas, themes, or specific games that you want to nominate, things you want to suggest, just ideas, maybe directions to take on Retroactive, please let us know.
And your ideas better not be, hey guys, you didn't do predictions yet. Fuck you. I know it's coming. Fuck you.
We'll do predictions.
You in advance.
Yeah,
we'll
just I'm holding James back. Just picture me holding James back right now.
Just hold me back, John.
Anyway, what we'd really like to do is do a poll, because that's the one way that we get the listeners to be involved and ultimately do something that a plurality of our listeners chose. So if you can suggest a set of games or a theme or something like that, maybe I'll arrange it into a theme, but we would like to set that up very soon, because I love doing Retroactive and I feel like it has been way too long. So you can send us an email with your ideas, rfn@nwr, or you can post them in the talkback for this, the article on the website for this episode. There is a dedicated forum thread for Retroactive ideas, and I do go to that when we get ready to do a new edition of it. So you can always, that's a sticky thread, so it's always at the top. You can find that in our forums, and you can always add stuff there. I would really appreciate it. Or you can tweet us. And I was thinking recently, it's been a long time since we mentioned our Twitter handles on the show, and being that it's a new year and maybe we have a few new listeners, maybe we should throw those out there. And we talk about video games an awful lot on Twitter. So if you want even more of our dumb ramblings, you really should follow us on Twitter. So I am @JohnnyNWR. And James, what about you?
Just NWR_James.
John?
I am Mr. Diamond J, MRDIAMONDJ.
Yeah.
Letter J.
I am Guillaume NWR. One word.
Guillaume NWR. And speaking of TYP, he just joined Twitter. We convinced him. I think people were mentioning him on Twitter over the weekend, and I kept reading tweets about him to him in person. And he said, I just don't do it. I just don't do it. And I guess he decided.
So good.
He Twitter reached is the so tipping good. Point. I know. It's I love Twitter.
It's pretty much the worst thing humanity's ever created.
If you love to write, Twitter is so good.
That's the worst part. Like, just like I can just shoot the idea I want to write out there and it's done.
Yeah.
I don't have to give you a big dumb preface on why the idea of making other Maker games from Nintendo franchises doesn't make any goddamn sense.
Yep.
I can just say, hey, Metroid Maker doesn't fucking work. Think about it, asshole. Yeah, well, I've got like 10 characters left to call you assholes again.
Yeah, and I'm just like, retweet, retweet, Jay's being a dick, retweet. Tweet.
So TYP joined Twitter about half an hour ago and already has 17 followers, and I think we can do way better than that. So you should follow our good friend Michael TYP Cole on Twitter. He is at Younger Plumber. There you go. Let's convince him to stick with it and show him why Twitter is awesome and super fun. Let's see. One other plug. I just published a book. So if you want to read a book that I wrote that has nothing to do with video games, it's on Amazon. It's a digital Kindle thing, and it's called Surviving Coventry. And if you just search for my name or if you search for that title, you'll find it. I think it costs $3, or if you have Prime or Kindle Unlimited, you can get it for free. And it's a short book. It's a true story about a road trip that I did with my friend Taylor 10 years ago. I wrote most of the story 10 years ago and then just updated it recently and added some pictures that we took. And I think it's a good story, but it's very specific. It's about us taking a really stupid road trip to go see a concert when we were young and very stupid. So if that sounds remotely interesting to you, please check it out. Let me know what you think. I would be honored if you gave it a little bit of your time to read that. And if not, you can completely ignore it, because again, it has zero. I don't think the word video games is ever mentioned in the book. It's just completely unrelated. But hey, there it is. And that's it. We'll be back next week with our top five games of 2014. I'm really excited about that, but it also means I have a lot of work to do. I have a lot of games to play this week. I know.
Why do we do this?
It's tough on all of us, but it's a fun challenge to do. So we hope you will enjoy it. We hope you'll be back next week. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Bye.
Later.
Fuck off.
Dramatic pause. Okay.